From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency. Ukraine's war with Russia is in its third year, and during that time, we have often heard about Russian attacks on Ukraine and its civilians and the deaths and damage they have caused. But the war has also impacted Ukraine's Orthodox Church. Flavius Mahaeus is a conflict journalist who visited Ukraine to find out firsthand how the church has been affected. He joins us on this edition of Update One. Flavius, welcome.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be back.
We should point out that after you visited Ukraine, you wrote an article for the American Conservative magazine talking about your experience there. You wrote at the very start of the article that the conflict reveals a complex interplay between faith, nationalism, and state power. If you can explain that.
Absolutely. With all the media coverage on the military conflict, and rightly so, it's a major conflict, and the U.S. and its allies have been helping Ukraine in that conflict. But there's a story that's not getting so much attention, but that has major implication on the outcome of the war and the unity of the Ukrainian people in fighting that war. It's the impact of the conflict on religious freedom, on religious practice of the Ukrainian. Perhaps to take a quick step back, Ukraine has historically been at the center of the Eastern European Orthodox world. It's on the banks of the Dnieper River, that major river that cut Ukraine in two. In Kyiv, specifically, that Eastern European Orthodoxy was born in 988. It was then a Slavic offshoot of the Byzantium Greek Orthodoxy, and reflecting its Slavic identity, it adopted liturgic language that's called Slavonic, which is a proto-Slavic language, similar to in liturgy we have in the Catholic Latin, for example. And the society in Ukraine to this day is still very, very religious. Many Ukrainians consider themselves as deeply religious, and the church is a central place for their identity as well. Of course, major life occasions, wedding, burials, but also even as I observed as a concert hall, the quality of Orthodox choirs, not only in Ukraine, I think amongst the Eastern Orthodox world, is absolutely beautiful. They many professional singer will also sing in the choir, and so you will often see Ukrainians gathering and going to the liturgy on a special feast, for example, because it will be even more of the choir performing. So it's a central place for it's a central role for Ukrainians. And what has happened since the beginning of the conflict, and with some roots earlier in the previous time, is that the traditional Ukrainian church, so that origin church, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, has found itself in the center of government accusation of being pro-Russian. And it's an allegation that the faithful from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church I met are rejecting, and are protesting, saying that, well, they are just as patriot as any Ukrainians. And the accusations, and more specifically, is kind of looking at the canonical link with the Ukrainian, with the Russian Orthodox Church, which is it's not operational, it's an administrative. The Ukrainian church is effectively a self-governing church. But behind that, there is also a contest between this church and a newer church, which is the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which was established shortly before the war in 2019 with the support of then-President Poroshenko, who believed that an independent national church was essential for national security, has this one nation, one church vision. So it's a church that is very much promoted by the government. And so unfortunately, the Ukrainian faithful have found themselves caught in that struggle. And the full force of the state law enforcement agency and the state muscles have been sort of at the service of the New York Church, if you wish.
Now, how difficult has it been for Ukrainians to maintain religious freedom while the war is going on?
It's a good question. Many Ukrainians that from the traditional church, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that I met, are confused and disoriented because they will do the fighting on the front line and they come back home on leaves or after their tour of duty and they find that their church building has been expropriated, has been forcibly transferred to the new church. And so it's creating division and tensions at a time where the unity of the country is very much needed to fight a war. They claim that they are unable to, there's no freedom of, or less freedom of assembly, less freedom of practicing their religion. And in fact, it's a claim that has been also identified by the United Nations. Over multiple reports and up to the most recent ones which is this year, the rapporteur, the United Nations rapporteur on freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, freedom of religions, has alerted the international community that the member of the traditional church, their freedom have been restricted. And so, so you have that situation where, again, at a time where you need unity, you have a divisive policy and divisive actions, and some including violence, violently expropriating the church building of the traditional church, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, to move them to the newer church, which from what I've witnessed has much less followers. And so as a result, coming back to freedom of religion, the members of the traditional church have found themselves without a temple or forced to gather in private homes, in less than optimal, even dangerous situation with fire hazard when you have too many people for a small place and a heater, charcoal heater. But their connections, again, back to the importance of religious identity for Ukrainians, their connection to their clergy, their connections to their faith, to their language as well, because one feature of the New York Church is that they use Ukrainian as a liturgy language, not Slavonic anymore. But for many Ukrainians, Slavonic is what they grew up with at the church. It's like if you replace Latin with French. Many people will say there's a great thing, but also many French will say, well, you know, I was raised with using Latin as my, and that's also kind of the electricity that connects me with previous generation who are also speaking Latin at church or hearing the mass in Latin. So this has put so much pressure and constraints on Ukrainians, and many of them have expressed their sadness and their fears that they will be stripped of their identity, if you wish, and in a bigger scheme, they will be distracted, to say the least, from the fighting and the unity they need to win that war.
What about the Ukrainian judicial system? During this religious conflict, has it gotten involved much? And if so, has it been very effective?
That's a good question. It's definitely one aspect of the issue that the United Nations has flagged, saying that the judiciary system has been instrumentalized by the state to prosecute the church, and there is a lack. The stories that I have heard, there is a lack of recourse, of due process, of fairness by the judiciary system. In situations where the members of the traditional church have sought recourse after they were expropriated from their temple, after they were attacked by military units or secret service. And in every single case, and I visited many, many villages and cities from Chernivtsi in the west near the Romania to Odessa in the south, Kiev, the capital, Khmelnytsky. In every single case where the community have been dispossessed of their church building, where communities have been the butt of physical aggression and violence, in no place they were able to make a case to the court and that case to be heard.
So it's had no impact.
So it had no impact. Or it actually has an impact to back up, to confirm, to support the aggression toward their church, not to protect them, defend them, or give them a fair hearing.
Now, I know in the article that you wrote for the American Conservative, you also mentioned the media have had a role in this conflict and social media as well. How so?
There is a censorship that I've been told. And indeed, if you screen the Ukrainian social media, you will hear very little from or in support of the traditional church. Some of it is a self-censorship, from what I've been told. That's more to do with the traditional media, where there have been threats to the TV channels or radio if they give time and attention to the position of the traditional church, including threats of losing their license to operate. So as a result, if you, like I did, zap TV channels in the evening after the day, you will see a very consistent, similar story about the Ukrainian church as spies, fifth column, not really Ukrainians, across the TV channels, wherever you are. So you have little voice, and that, of course, has had an impact on the public opinion. And in some villages, the faithful told me that fellow villagers or community members that have been their friends for many, many years. I mean, they've lived together, they went to each other's weddings. Suddenly they turn against them and call them Muscovite and say, well, we've never been to Moscow. And, you know, we fight and die along your sons and your uncles and your fathers. And they claim the media has played a role into portraying their friends as such.
With the media having an impact on public opinion, generally speaking, what is the public's view of this religious conflict?
In Ukraine, I think there is a lot of confusion, discomfort, because again, religious identity and the social life around the religious identity is so prominent in Ukraine that dividing policy or that the actions that have been taken against the traditional church is polarizing the country and the public opinion is again, the Ukrainians, they are very much connected to their local community, to the local priest, and for them to be stripped of that, it is definitely harming them.
You mentioned earlier that the United Nations is aware of what's going on and is investigating. What can the UN do regarding this religious conflict in Ukraine?
It's a good question. The short answer is not much. The UN, as you know just as well, is what member states make of it. And we see that in other situations, like in Gaza, for example, and elsewhere. But it does show that there is a concerns that go beyond the members of the targeted church, the member of the traditional church, that you have professional investigators, the UN investigators, independent investigators. That's the role of so-called the rapporteur, which is spelled the French way, R-A-P-P-O-R-T-E-U-R, which is a reporter in a legal sense, that they went there and they collected those evidences and they collected those testimonies, and that there is enough for them to, again, raise a flag there and essentially ask the international community to pay attention. And you have a similar work done, for example, on starvation in Gaza, right? You have independent evaluators, you have independent legal experts who go there and say, well, this is an issue we can recognize as legitimate, and we call for the international community to pay more attention. And this is important because in the U.S. we're not so aware that the U.N. has done that work vis-a-vis religious persecution in Ukraine. And it's important because we give a lot of support to the Ukrainian government, right? And so many Ukrainians from the members of the traditional church, they say, you know, please continue support us. Without you, we wouldn't be able to prosecute the fight against Russia, and we need to fight Russia. But be a little bit more cautious and please do some oversight on how your funding is used or misused to persecute us, not to proceed the war, not to help us fight the war. Again, because of the involvement of the state law enforcement agencies, the courts, the social media, etc.
I know during your time in Ukraine, you talked to a lot of people. You talked to parishioners of both the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. And you write that many of them, most of them, consider themselves patriots. And they had stories of volunteering, fighting, dying for their country. It seems like this religious conflict may remain unsettled long beyond the war. It seems like this could go on for a long time.
That's a very good point. It's important for your audience to understand that there has been a very strong nationalistic element of Ukrainian society, that's been there before the war, and it's been there, it will be there after the war. That's how nations express themselves, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But the church has become, over the last 30 years, part of that national identity in a way that is divisive. And indeed, this is not going to go away, plausibly, it's not going to go away tomorrow. Hence, it makes our role as friends of Ukraine all the more important, so we don't leave, we don't exacerbate or fuel a conflict, but we help actually bring all the sides together within Ukrainian society. Because even many Ukrainians, when I talk to them, they know who's who. They say, oh yeah, we have the Russian speaking in the east, we have the nationalist in the north with near Lviv, and we have the Romanian speaking Ukrainian near Romania, we have the Hungarian speaking Ukrainian, and sort of that's part of the mosaic of the Ukrainian identity. And so our role, I think, as friend of Ukraine is to help preserve that. And it's having spent time in Switzerland, to me, when I spent after a few days in Ukraine, it was impressive to see how, for example, as I mentioned, I went in Chernivtsi. I was in Chernivtsi and I crossed from Romania into Ukraine, and to see those Ukrainians just as Ukrainian and patriotic as any, but going to Romanian school, speaking Romanian, but having no interest or no, you know, tie to Romania beyond the language and a friendly neighbor. And it's Ukraine at its best looks to me as a giant Switzerland, where you have these different identities coexisting, and maintaining that balance is quite a feat, and to the credit of Ukraine as well.
This is all part of the article you've written for the American Conservative. How can people go about reading that?
Oh, thank you. If you go to theamericanconservative.com. And you search for my first name, Flavius, you should find the article, or you can reach out directly on X, you can say Twitter anymore, at Flavius Oxford, in one word, Flavius Oxford.
Flavius, thanks for sharing your findings on Update One.
Thank you for having me again, Mike. It's a pleasure always.
I'm Mike Hempen. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.